Hello, I'm Katie Manning, and you're very lucky because you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Enjoy!
I'm Kier.
And I'm Alyssa from In Defense Of, a proud member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to now.
The opinions expressed are those of the individual hosts and guests.
Be sure to check out all the other podcasts available at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
And get ready, because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1. Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Whittaker and beyond. Your GPR hosts are Jay Witten.
Safety measures are for chumps who don't know what they're doing.
Kier Hansen.
Oh, hold on. I saw it on my mixer. I turned up the suck. Hold on.
And Haley Malley.
I feel like I might need to carb up for next week's episode.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do discuss recent news, episodes that have already aired in their home territories, and the occasional interesting rumor. But don't worry, if we look too far into the future, we'll give you a fair warning. Welcome to episode 301 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where science is magic, death is curable, and bug bodies beat human bodies 8 ways to Sunday. I am Kier.
I am Haley.
And I'm Jay, and this week we throw the switch, summon the lightning, and see what happens when Terry Dix and Robert Holmes disagree on how to incorporate Mary Shelley into Doctor Who, and the monstrous form of a criminal pastime lord is reanimated in the brain of Morbius. Joining us for the look back to January of 1976 is another creature of the 70s, friend of GPR and Whovians everywhere, Jeremy Raddick. Welcome back, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me. Congrats on 300, guys.
Thank you very much. As always. We always like to start these classic rewatches with a little bit of a kind of your hot take, your quick reactions, based on how many times you have or have not seen this story before. And since Haley is our poster child for the new experience here, we will just confirm, Haley, is this your first watch in its entirety of The Brain of Morbius?
Yes, of course it is. I finished it 15 minutes ago.
Excellent. I would expect nothing less.
She's okay. Ahead of schedule.
I was. I was done like 10 minutes before we started podcasting. It was awesome.
That's great. Fantastic. So that being unfathomably fresh in your head, what's your general take on the story?
I liked almost all of it. It's not often we see the Doctor straight up murder somebody, but, you know, it happens.
Okay. Yes, definitely something to stick a pin in here. All right. Jay, how about your experience and general impressions of the story?
I have seen it. It seemed very familiar to me, but it's been a very long time. So almost first time viewing, I guess.
Okay. And based on that renewal in your working memory, what was your takeaway?
It was actually kind of interesting. Just it seemed like a departure from the typical story that we've been getting lately, a little more horror, that kind of thing. But I enjoyed it.
Okay. Now, Jeremy, I know this is really just going to be something short of laughable. But how many times would you say you've seen this story through?
I've seen it a bunch. This has been one that it was one of the first ones I ever saw, actually. So I've seen it a lot. So this is probably, in my memory, the fifth or sixth time that I've watched it at least. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you still get something new out of it at each pass?
Sometimes. I think it depends on how long it's been since I've watched it, and like also in the way you watch it too. I mean, one of the beautiful things about having it on DVD is you can watch it with the commentary, you can watch it with the info text, you can watch it with all that stuff turned off and just kind of try to dive back into the show. And so this time I watched it without the info text, and I just watched it as an episode, and I actually did some spacing between episodes. So instead of watching it all the way through in like 90 minutes, I watched it and then gave it a couple hours and then watched it. And so I tried to kind of, synthetically make it similar to how they would have watched it back in the day.
Right, trying to give the cliffhangers some weight once again.
Terrible cliffhangers in this one, but we'll get into it. And some of them are, anyways.
They build. Look at the mechanics of what each cliffhanger is, as far as what happens at each closing moment, and it's just further and further interactions of Sarah Jane and the Brain. Which is not a good Animaniacs cartoon. Sarah Jane and the Brain did not do very well.
I would pay money to watch that.
Or at least get on a T-shirt for that. That is true. I would probably say this is maybe my fourth or fifth time through the story in its completion. You know, I'd grab bits and pieces along the way and just say, "Oh yeah, this is the Frankenstein take that was during Hinchcliffe's big run on monster takes." So let's kind of look into that, because obviously by basic storylines, we're looking at the Frankenstein story, but this went through some permutations that came with some wrinkles in the production process, or at least in the story creation process. Jay Haley, I don't know if you're really familiar with some of the nuances as to what happened behind the scenes when the story was originally being penned and then when it was being prepared for its teleplay. But Jeremy, can you kind of fill us in a little bit on how you understand the wrinkle between Terrence Dicks and Robert Holmes?
Yeah. Well, I mean, basically, I think what happened was that, and the idea came from Hinchcliffe originally. I think Hinchcliffe wanted to do a sort of pastiche on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and that as that was their starting point for a lot of things in this era. Mm-hmm. And so Holmes came and gave the directive to Terrence Dicks, who wrote, as I understand it, like a pretty different take on it, much less horror influence, that revolved around a robot that was trying to build this sort of body for Morbius. Mm-hmm. And this is where my memory gets a little cloudy, but I believe that he handed in a script and then either went away. I mean, that's a weird thing in the history of Doctor Who, where like writers hand in a script and then they go to Majorca for like 6 weeks and are unreachable in the 70s and no one knows how to get in touch with them. But anyways, it needed rewrites. Robert Holmes wrote basically a page one rewrite and jettisoned a substantial amount of Terrence Dicks stuff. He got rid of the robot. He created Solon, and I think the Sisterhood of Karn wasn't in it, and basically just pushed it entirely towards this entirely different vibe of horror and all that sort of stuff. And he wrote, I think he sent the letter back to Terrence Dicks, and here's your wonderful Brain of Morbius script, and Terrence Dicks said something to the effect of, you know, it's a very nice script. It's not my script, but it's a very nice script. And he said, I would appreciate it if you just take my name off of it and put on some bland pseudonym. And and so as a way of a joke between the two guys, Robert Holmes renamed the writer of this script Robin Bland as a sort of way of combining both Dix's efforts and Holmes's efforts. But it definitely is much more, I think, at the end of the day, a Robert Holmes script than it is a Terrence Dicks script. It doesn't have that sort of structure that a Terrence Dicks script usually has, which is really very tight and incident heavy and action packed. It's much more atmospheric and character rich, and that tends to be more Robert Holmes.
Absolutely. I think with regards to the nom de usage that went on there, the pseudonym that actually, I think that was, if I remember, that was the actual, that was the apology salvo that went back. And it actually, after some time, Terrence Dicks was not on speaking terms with him for quite some time after this. It caused that much of an upset. But when he finally saw it aired and saw the name that got applied to the writing credits, he kind of chuckled to himself and, all was generally forgiven.
They were super tight. I mean, Holmes, there's a great story about Holmes coming on the show with the Crotons and stuff like that. And one of the only reasons why Robert Holmes ever wrote for Doctor Who, because he submitted scripts and got rejected. But Terrence Dicks, when he came on board as script editor in the 60s, the only reason why Holmes was sort of able to put a script in is because a script fell through and they didn't have anything else. And Terrence Dicks said, well, I've been working with this guy, Robert Holmes, on this script he submitted for weeks, because they had been secretly working on the Crotons. So, I mean, there was a lot, they were pretty close and they did have some falling outs, as you do. But I think by the time this serial aired. I think he saw it in the Radio Times and saw the credit and went and laughed and went, okay. And he picked up the phone and called him, and all was forgiven by that point.
I have a question about this kind of thing. This isn't the first time we've seen a script that had somebody's pseudonym on it. It's not the last time we'll see it. How much was the audience at the time aware of what was going on, or even cared about who was writing the episodes?
As far as I ever understood it, this was something that was entirely inside baseball. That may prove differently as the years go by and more occurrences of this come to light and the audience starts becoming, or at least some of the really fanatical viewing audience starts to become a little bit more savvy to these things. I don't know exactly how much lead time they would get when they see the previews, the write-ups in the Radio Times, sort of as, you know, as we in the States would have recognized as getting your TV guide a couple of weeks prior and seeing who's being credited for upcoming episodes of whatever your favorite program is. Recognizing writers' names, especially greatly predating any sort of networked computer system to be able to track these things, has got to be extremely difficult. So you're relying entirely on your periodicals, maybe a radio program or two, but I don't think those kind of things would generally be discussed. So I don't think public awareness, even if they saw it, wouldn't be quite cognizant of what they were seeing or to be in on the joke. I don't know.
You'd have to be someone like Nigel Neal, who did all the Quatermass stuff. You'd have to be someone so famous that their name was an industry in and of itself. And I can't remember who wrote Gangsters in the 80s, but there's somebody who, Philip something, I can't remember his last name, and someone, Paul Cornell's shouting at me right now. But there was a gentleman who wrote for Doctor Who in the 80s who ran his own show, and that was something of a get. And there were some people that came aboard, but... yeah, I don't think anybody really would have noticed or known that Robin Bland was a pseudonym, or, you know, David Agnew was everybody. You know, I don't think they would have known necessarily.
Yeah, exactly. Now, we were just discussing the fact that we're doing these nice pastiches of these classic horror stories, and this was sort of something where I guess it was probably more guided by Phil Hinchcliffe's hand than it was Bob Holmes as sort of the pen behind it, as far as this pursuit of these gothic classic horror tropes, whether it be Morbius sort of being the Frankenstein pull, Seeds of Death being taken from The Thing, Pyramids of Mars, loosely sort of the Mummy story. It's there, but you venture off that pretty quickly. And then possibly even Talons of Wen Chiang as, Phantom of the Opera. But this was the real point of uprising. What was Mary Whitehouse's organization?
Yeah, kind of like the Legion of Decency sort of thing, but they were called something else. Yeah.
Yeah, something of the sort. So it was basically this, this righteous organization that wanted to get filth off of television. And there was this general concern over the nature of horror and darkness and potentially, demonic representation and all of these things. And you have stories that come out like this, and it was just playing right into their hands. But I don't think Hinchcliffe and company let off on the throttle for some time. You get a headless beast that rises up off the table and basically just clunked together from all these parts. Oh, a human arm, bug body, no head, just some little tendrils hanging out there. Yeah, I can see that as being something where, based on their degree of sensitivity to begin with, that this was going to... this was going to throw some flares into the air, but it didn't stop them for some time. I mean, they carried this sort of motif through for a number of stories to follow, almost as if they were goading them. But Jay Haley, I mean, as far as you were seeing this, I mean, I've always remarked on how dark this particular story was, obviously just because of the tale they were telling, and what they were drawing from, but also just visually, thematically, artistically, the canvas of the sets, what was being done, which was actually, I think it was pretty incredible what they were doing for an entirely interior shoot. But did this feel like... you had said that this was something where it felt like, to you, Jay, this was a bit of a turn, or this was maybe a next level of storytelling. What was it specifically that really felt like we had turned a corner or had sort of upped the ante on how we were telling these sci-fi slash horror tales?
I think a lot of it is, like you mentioned, the darkness of it. Because we've been on space stations that are all brightly lit. We've been on alien worlds that, you know, they've got decent lighting and things like. And here you had a lot of contrast. There were shadows in the corners. There was always an area on the screen that you could imagine there was something hiding, waiting to pop it. Like, it just had that feel where, you know, not everything was being shown to you. Like, mm-hmm. there was always something that was just on the periphery that could come and ruin things at any moment. And it added a level of tension that you didn't really get in stories previously.
Okay. All right. Haley, would you sync with that, or is there something else to it?
I think that part is true. Also, maybe I'm just not remembering, but when Kondo was shot, I think that was a more gruesome depiction of somebody being shot than we had seen up to that point.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'm remembering, like, a lot of people, like, you either turn so you don't see the wound, or, you know, it's just a red spot on the shirt. Like, there was, yeah. like, a no, blood
it was,
splash.
It was usually just a puff of spoke. This yeah. was an actual squib.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember seeing that on an episode before this one.
Yeah, that is a possibility. Yeah, as far as just the graphic nature of it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, you'd be absolutely remiss. You know, you can talk about the story and its permutations and the theme and the concept all day long, but this what really, really drives this home for me personally, and Jeremy, I think you're going to chime in on this, is the individual performances. Mm-hmm. One in particular being very, very near and dear to your heart. Do you want to...
Are you talking about Philip Maddock?
Let's go.
Oh my God, I love Philip Maddock. Philip Maddock is like in the Doctor Who like Hall of Fame of guest star actors, and there have been a lot of really great guest star actors.
Yeah,
Bernard Kay and Kevin Stoney and all these, you know, Gene Marsh and all these wonderful actors. But I love Philip Maddock in everything he ever did in Doctor Who, particularly this story. He's okay. So funny. He plays Solon, and I think he's really, really funny and creepy, and he's one of the few Doctor Who adversaries. When he lies to the Doctor and to Sarah, you can almost see why someone would believe him. Does that make sense? Like, you know, the scenes where he's like helping them with Sarah's blindness, and you can see that he's really trying to kind of, oh no, I'm it's all a big misunderstanding, you know. And it's just he's so good at not tipping his hand in that way, and mm-hmm. you know, and he's just killingly funny. The scene where the Doctor and Sarah arrive at his castle, and mm-hmm. He looks at Tom Baker and he goes, "What a magnificent head, superb head." I mean, he can't help saying it, and it's so yeah. funny. It's just the most. It's unbelievable. He's just so great all the way through. Every scene that he's in is terrific, and I can't help but think about it in contrast to the previous time he appeared in the show, which is the War Games, where he plays the Warlord, and it's a totally different performance.
Performance, but the degree of commitment to mm-hmm. the character is absolutely there.
Absolutely.
I mean, as far as he's playing this to such a degree, well, specifically, you know, taking the mad scientist role, but not going the criminally insane. He keeps at least the facade of sanity in check until things are really starting to go off the rails for him. But yeah. his determination to see his project to its completion and to serve his master in that regard are so single-minded that I think that's why the little decisions about he can't help but make the little aside statements and such.
Yeah.
Or to go through this great exposition to Kondo, who's probably only picking up about a fifth of what he's saying whatsoever.
oh, Kondo.
But, well, all right.
Oh, Kondo.
So, all right, let's take this for a second, because Kondo, this poor schlub, can we just put the obvious question out there, and we'll all just sort of go around and try and figure out why this was never done. So why didn't we just use Kondo as the body?
Well, because he'd promised him he'd give him his arm back. So, you know, had to, I don't know.
He needed somebody to do the heavy lifting to go find a head.
I think there's a bigger logic hole in it, which is, you know, when the doctor arrives and he knocks him out, why does he continue to want to use his patchwork hodgepodge body? Why doesn't he just put Morbius's brain in? And I think it's because Solon is just so fixated on his own achievement of having put together this thing that's what he wants to do.
There something in the dialogue that said that there was a need to have some of the oh God, what was the, help me out on the original species that the bug body was. That was
the mutt or whatever it was.
The mutt, that's right, the mutt from the mutants.
Yeah.
That it needed some of the biological resilience.
I guess. I mean, I think it's all pretty, you know, truth be told, it's all pretty silly, actually. But I mean, but I think it's, you know, I mean, to me, I always just explain it as Solon's achievement. He wants to have built this thing. That's what he wants to have done. More even than his devotion to Morbius. He wants to have built this patchwork body, and he's just locked into it. And it makes him make mistakes. I mean, that's really, he makes a lot of mistakes. But I totally buy it based on how, you know, obsessively feverish Philip Maddock is in this performance with his wonderful wig and terrific facial hair.
It's always the facial hair. Come on, that's half of his persona.
Yeah,
I mean, let's take it back to the warlord here. All right. Well, there's one other aspect of performances that I think lends itself when we get into stories that are of darker subject material or at least darker tones like this. This is more reminiscent of, I mean, this being into Baker's sophomore year, but he's still keeping it very light and whimsical and unpredictable and really, really eccentric to the nth degree. And it's a far cry from what we have from the Fourth Doctor within a couple of seasons. But right now, Jay, since you know where his doctor heads, you know, you know what we end up getting from later, by the time we get around to like season 16 or so and Shada and all those things. But taking darker stories like this, as long as you have the light, dare say zany Fourth Doctor, makes it a little easier to put that little beacon of crazy hope against the darker canvas. Do you feel that plays specifically, or is that just something? Do you think that was intentional, or was that just serendipitous that's what Baker was bringing to the table at that time while the stories were so heavy?
I don't know. I feel like this was probably I don't know. I do think that it was probably just that's just how Baker is. Like he can't go too serious for extended periods of time without doing something to try and make people laugh. That's just how his doctor was the entire time. And there were times where, I mean, the darker the situation is, the more serious he can become, but it's not going to last.
Okay. Haley, did you have any sort of a realization or reaction to the way he was sort of counterpointing the nature of individual scenes? I mean, there's times when he would flip within a line and, you know, start something serious with the sisterhood and then crack the joke, or begin in a light tone but then stick a barb in at the end of seriousness to sort of serve as the warning.
Yeah, it's almost like a stand-up comedian, like being a master of controlling the tension in the scene. Like, I'm gonna ratchet up the tension and then snap it with a joke, or like just keep it super light and then all of a sudden bring in the tension at the very end, and just to control the emotion that is in the scene.
Okay.
That's what I'm seeing from him.
Chop Suey the Galactic Emperor.
Yeah.
Fair. Now, one thing that I wanted to sort of check with you all, there's sort of two themes that are going on here, and one is obviously the fact that we're taking a sort of a very different pull on the Shelley story, in which case the roles of monster and creator are almost reversed. You know, the guiding hand in this case being the monster asking for his own completion, and the creator is being the one being manipulated, if you want to sort of recognize it as such. But there was something else that the more times I rewatch this story, the more I start to pick up on it. And it really wasn't until maybe about the last two times I saw it through when I was really focusing on the sisterhood, because of obviously, you know, the fact that we've brought them back into recognizable modern Who canon to great success. I mean, they're fascinating, you know, return to the characters. Whether or not we see any more of them at this point remains to be seen. But there was this potential theme, and I want to see whether or not, whether this is just me picking at straws here, where it was, where they were focusing on the dangers of fanaticism in isolation. And it was sort of, and I was noticing this because it could be recognized on both of your sets of adversaries, if you want to recognize the sisterhood as adversarial for the vast majority of the story. Obviously, with Solon and Kondo and working for Morbius, this is something where they've been single-mindedly pursuing this for so long and scavenging these crashed ships and going after this thing that they are laser-focused on returning Morbius to power so he can continue his domination of planet after planet after planet. And there's the crazed fanaticism that has happened because they've been left forgotten, believed to be dead, and he can continue to focus on this for as long as they need to. But the Sisterhood, to a certain degree, were also isolated insofar as being close enough to Gallifrey, but far enough that they are not really aware of anything that has changed. So they're still sort of living in this archaic practice. And the Doctor calls them out on that, the fact that refers to it as quaint at one point, but then there's times when he refers to it as potentially dangerous, and the fact that they're not aware of how things have progressed. Would you say that this is a legitimate theme that is being actively explored, or did this just happen to be a thread that ran through multiple storylines? Is anybody else catching on this?
I think the Sisterhood isn't... I kind of feel like I would love to see a woman write the Sisterhood, because neither Terrence Dix nor Robert Holmes could be effectively congratulated for their feminism. Mm. They're pretty stodgy. But there's elements, like, I think it's tough because I think they're looked down upon quite heavily by all the characters in the piece. And the Doctor's sort of, and rebuke to them is that they've sort of stultified or calcified their society because they've become so focused on this immortality that they haven't advanced themselves. They haven't grown. They haven't become, more than what they are because they live forever. And I think that's an interesting question. I think that it would be interesting to see someone tackle them in the modern sense that, and I don't know, maybe Big Finish has done this, it's possible, or the novels, to kind of see them as a bit more of a rejection, because there's a bit of a, it's a little, like Doctor Knows Best, and the classic series is always guilty of that at some point, of that paternalism, mm-hmm. I think their society, I still don't really get what they're trying to say in this particular story about the Sisterhood. And there's a lot of early scenes where they're just exposition land, and they just kind of fill in a bunch of stuff, and then they sort of act as obstacle or safety net. To me, the one of the weak points of this story is the depiction of the Sisterhood, which I think is a really interesting concept, but I just feel like neither Terrence Dix nor Robert Holmes is really that interested in taking them to an interesting place, other than the Doctor kind of tutting their reliance on an elixir, So,
right.
That's a bit too bad, but I get what you're saying. I don't think you're wrong. I just think that there's definitely places to go with that I don't think the story 100% commits to.
Okay. As far as high and low points in the story, just in general, I mean, things that are the real the zenith and the nadir of where your takeaways are from this, Haley, what would you say are the aspects of it that really shine the brightest, and the things that you would like to see brightened on reflection?
I really like Sarah Jane a whole lot. Not that's a new thing. Just her, like, her being the one to rescue the Doctor, and I mean, that's the role of the companion, really, is to rescue the Doctor. And just the relationship between the Doctor and Sarah Jane at this point, I think, is really fantastic.
And her Matt Murdock impression,
very well. Right, staring off into the middle distance.
She had it down.
But she's great. She's great in episode one. I mean, she fakes being drugged and she figures a whole bunch of stuff out. She's fantastic in that first episode.
She's the only one smart enough not to take the drink from the mad scientist.
Yeah, she's great.
The doctor's still busy pouting over the fact that the Time Lord sent him there. He can't focus.
All right. And what would you say would be the point that, if you were given the red pen, that you would put a slash through and say, no, go back, revisit.
Well, rewrite, revise. Jeremy said, kind of the way the sisterhood was handled. Here's this sisterhood that has found a potion for immortality, and it can't be something that they developed themselves. It's like the doctor makes a point of saying, like, oh, it's just like a fluke of the geology here. Like, it just anybody, it would have happened with anybody. So, it's not an accomplishment of theirs. And then even after they've discovered it, like, oh, it's a terrible thing, too. Like, you're awful for using this, even though the Time Lords use it, even though the Time Lords are dicks in every way and are doing pretty much the same thing with a different mechanic.
Yeah. We do get a good step forward as far as a backstory and understanding of the Time Lord, the hierarchy, the organizational structure, some of their interactions with species, especially as you get closer to home, and their manipulation and just outright plaything mentality towards other species, even though the Sisterhood themselves consider the Time Lords to be the closest thing they have to an intellectual equal. Okay. Jay, what would you say would be the high and low?
I've got to agree with Haley. I think that Sarah Jane is probably my favorite thing out of this. Aside from just the new darker tone that this story kind of takes that we haven't seen before, I enjoyed Sarah Jane so very much in this one. Even with the blind aspect and stuff, and just how she managed to handle that after the initial, like, crap, I can't see, knock things over a little bit. But even then, she became competent even in that. Mm-hmm. As far as like the negative thing, I cannot take Kondo seriously. I'm sorry. It's just every time he speaks, I'm just kind of like, oh, can we just give him like a robot or something? Just this is obnoxious.
Girl pretty, that's the worst.
Kondo, the best part was when he was helping her while she was blind and walked her straight into like a box or something. Did you notice that?
Kondo, sorry.
Mungo like beans. All right. Jeremy, where would you put your gold star and your red X?
Well, the gold star is the production aspect of the piece. I think, the Hinchcliffe-Holmes era is really, he overspent like bananas, which is why Graham Williams never has any money. But one of the things that always blows my mind in this, aside from the performances, is like you go into Solon's castle and it feels like more than just one room in a hallway. It feels like there's upstairs, there's downstairs. You get a real sense of how everything works. All the sets are beautiful and really atmospheric, and the way it's directed is scary. It's not a science fiction story. This is a horror movie. Mm-hmm. And it goes all out for it. And, Philip Maddock's performance is really rich and beautiful, and everybody's great in it. I mean, Tom Baker's just super funny. There was another great funny line when the sisters are all chanting and about to burn him alive, and he gets rescued, and he says that music was terrible. There's so much great stuff in it all the way through. It's just a really easy watch. But the low point for me is that it is, I think, the same thing that makes it great for all that atmosphere. I think they also take it way too far. I think it is way too violent. There's a severed head in the first episode. There's a headless body. Kondo gets shot and bleeds out all over the place. I mean, it is a brain falls on the floor. Like, we watch a brain with a splat fall on the floor. And this went out at like 5 o'clock on a Sunday. And Doctor Who is a family show. I think it is. I'm not a prude or anything. I think where it's appropriate, that kind of violence and explicitness is fine. But I do feel like this is an Image of the Fendal. They go a little too far. And I think some of the complaints are totally accurate. There's no reason, especially since Kondo doesn't die from being shot by Solon. He gets killed by Morbius. So why does his stomach need to explode on camera? There's no reason for it other than the fact that they wanted that to happen. So I feel like everything that makes the story kind of memorable and scary, I think, is also they were going a bit too far at this point. They were, and that's the thing that I think bothers me the most about this story. Every time I watch it, the more I watch it, the more I go, ooh, that's a little, much, you know. Yeah. So that's the thing.
Well, Jay, and you had said it right at the outset there, the fact of taking Solon out with cyanide gas was a bit of a throw, and it was just done. Oh, okay, just move right off, and then you can argue, well, maybe he wasn't dead. We don't actually see him getting rolled out. He gets a very anticlimactic. He falls behind the gurney, and then at that point, he's kind of gone from view. But yeah. But nonetheless, it just seems to be a very casual kill. I don't know.
There wasn't even sort of also swinging of hands we get when the doctor's making a decision that's going to result in somebody's death.
Yeah,
that hasn't really started to kick in yet. But with regards to the brain falling on the floor, 5-second rule.
I was going to say that at the end. That was going to be my thing out. Thanks.
Sorry, you can't use that because, you know, it's still viable for at least 5 seconds before the damage, but you can't put it in the body.
Have you ever heard that story Tom Baker told once about when they were rehearsing that scene?
No.
And the jar tips over and the brain falls on the floor. And instead of doing his scene, Philip Matta just looked over and went, "Ooh, sorry, Morbius." That's all he said. And it absolutely made Tom Baker just collapse in hysterics. He thought it was the funniest thing he'd ever heard. So that's what I think whenever I see the brain fall on the floor. I think of Philip Matta going, "Sorry, Morbius." You know.
There were some ad-libs, I think, that made it into the final cut, if I remember correctly. I have to go back and identify exactly which ones they were.
Can you spare a glass of water when they're standing at the door? Which is a pretty funny line. I bet for some reason that music was terrible. I think that's a Tom Baker. That sounds like Tom Baker to me.
Yeah, that sounds like an ad. Yeah. Now, just as far as the one last thing that is just a matter of an interesting sort of bullet. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. We have a laboratory/castle here that is being established within an old hydrogen reactor, right? I mean, we're at that sort of a structure. Our mind bending duel, the apparatus that just happens to be there.
That's pretty convenient. One.
Yeah, well, you know, you got that going for you. So the MacGuffin kicks in, and that's great. But the do we want to just go around the horn real quick and just say what we think of the additional faces scene? Just for ha-has, okay? So, Haley, I'm gonna give this to you first, because if you count all the faces seen, if there was any sort of an inclination from any of the viewing audience that this was actually the Doctor's faces, you know, we go all the way back to Hartnell, and then we see an additional series of faces, if you count them up, that would have meant that we are standing in front of the 12th Doctor.
That would have been very interesting, and I would have liked that a lot, like, as a mechanic in a show, that we didn't start at the beginning of the Doctor's life. You know, we picked up somewhere in the middle, and he'd had adventures before with different faces.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But as you saw it, and especially because you were seeing this for the absolute first time, what was your take on what was actually going on when those additional faces appeared?
Well, at first I was thinking, was this at the time supposed to indicate that there were faces of the Doctor that we had not seen? And then I thought maybe these were supposed to have been Morbius's faces.
Okay.
We were getting some sort of feedback, and that's what we were seeing.
Right. Jay, I mean, I'm sure you've sort of gone back and forth on this at this point, but what do you think was their original intent?
You know, I like to tell myself that it's just, you know, first it's the Doctor kind of dominating everything, and then it starts showing Morbius's faces, because then he starts to take control, and that's how, like, that's kind of headcanon for me right now, because, you know, the Doctor's winning, and then Morbius starts winning and eventually wins totally. So it's just, that's kind of how I played it off in my head. But, you know, it does give a lot of room to be like, you know, there's more to the Doctor's story than when we come across. I mean, clearly he's had a very full life before we meet him in the junkyard. So who's to say that that was the first iteration?
Right. Absolutely. Jeremy, do you recall whether that struck you at any point when you were seeing the additional faces? I mean, granted, we don't get the 12 count factor until like Deadly Assassin, right?
That's when that comes in, and I think like I don't know. I think you can see it either way. Like, I watched the scene today when I was finishing it up, and I really thought to myself, okay, how could you view it? And looking at it from the directorial point of view, you get, you know, the four the three previous faces of the Doctor that we'd seen, but it does then cut to Tom Baker and Morbius, which gives you enough separation that I think it can satisfy whatever way you want to think. So you can think to yourself, those are previous incarnations of the Doctor, or you can think to yourself, that's Morbius. I think it, if you think that it's Morbius, the only benefit to that in the sense of watching it is that it does tell a story of the battle, right? Because otherwise the battle doesn't make any sense, right? You're just watching. But if you see it that, like, okay, the Doctor's faces come up, and that's because Morbius is kind of winning and stealing his lives, and then the Doctor, you know, draws upon some strength, and then he drains Morbius's life, or whatever the rules of mind bending are. who knows what that is? It's like wrestling, I guess, he tries to say. I think it would have been better if it had just been Tom Baker in a unitard wrestling that guy with, you know, busting a folding chair over his head in a cage match. Oh, yeah. But that would have been exciting.
Now I want to see Jodie Whittaker do that.
Oh, that would be great. A wrestling episode? That'd be fantastic. So I don't know. I think you can see it both ways. This time watching it, I had no problem going, okay, that's Morbius's other lives, and that's totally fine. It made complete sense to me that it worked that way. So.
All right. And the last thing to go around on is just our usual takes on rewatchability and recommendability. Specifically, if you have someone who is looking to situation A, they are looking to build their Classic Who repertoire in general. And second situation, someone who specifically wants to get to know the Fourth Doctor. So, Haley, where would you take this?
I think it's an important episode to watch. You get the introduction of the Sisterhood of Karn. You get a lot of talk about the Time Lords and what their society and hierarchy and all of that is like. So I think it's an important episode to watch as like a foundation, you know, building your library of Classic Who knowledge. Okay. As far as getting to know the Doctor, it is a good, like, Sarah and the Doctor interacting with each other. It's a good look at that. I don't know if the tone is necessarily a good episode to indicate, like, hey, this is what Doctor Who is like. That would be my only hesitation.
Okay, understood. Jay, how would you feel about that?
Yeah, I would say that rewatchable, absolutely. It is fun. It is a good story all around. Recommendability, you have to be careful because this is a departure. This is a little bit different. There is a lot of stuff that you're getting into some heady material with the Sisterhood of Karn, with the history of the Time Lords and things like that. If somebody is already like well into the Classic era, or specifically into Baker, then yeah, I'd recommend it. But at that point, I don't think I'd need to recommend it. They're already well on their way. So I'm going to say no for recommendability.
Okay. All right. With that caveat.
No.
Okay. Jeremy?
I think it's a good, I think one of the things that makes it really, really good for newer viewers is to kind of, it's very accessible. It's extremely easy to follow. It's not so crazily big in science fiction concepts that you can't just sort of dive in. If you've never seen Doctor Who before and you kind of just watch this one, it'll wash over you and it'll feel great and it'll be entertaining and there's lots of atmosphere and you'll get the relationships very quickly. So I think in that sense, it's really a good story for that. On the other hand, I think what you guys have said before is really true. It's not really representative of the Fourth Doctor, other than it being sort of a horror pastiche. I don't think it's a great showcase for Baker. I think there are better showcases for the Fourth Doctor, where you'll really see him take center stage and command whole scenes. I don't know that he really does it here to the degree that he does it in other episodes. But, you know, it is, I think, if you want to ease someone into what Doctor Who is, it's not a bad place to start. I really love it because I think it's super well done and it's super atmospheric. But I don't think it's tremendously representative of Tom Baker, but it is accessible.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
And I guess, and we've had these conversations before about if you're trying to get someone into the program and you're knowing that they're coming from a foundation of liking classic horror flicks, you know, like Hammer House or something like that, then okay, then maybe this is something that you can use as a touch point that they can work from and say, all right, this is familiar territory, but it's got the science fiction aspect of it, but it's not painted, you know, an inch thick, so I can grasp it and we'll move on from there. Okay.
Yeah. And it looks great. I mean, it looks really good. I don't just mean in like in terms of like not looking cheap, but also like the monster suits are great and everything, but also it's lit really well and directed really well. So that's that's a big plus, I think, too.
Definitely. Great. All right. Well, before we get into the brief bit of well, brief but pivotal bit of news that we have from this past week, Jeremy, if you'll indulge us for a second, we actually want to take some upcoming news aspects and pick your brain on it for a minute.
Oh, okay.
We'll tee it up with as comfortable of a meatball as we can. So, okay. Well, one of the things we'll be getting to momentarily when we get to the news discussion is the fact that we won't get into the actual date of it, but it has been confirmed that we are looking at a Sunday broadcast slot, which people are sort of all over the place right now. A lot of people are really embracing it. Some people are really kind of railing against it because they feel that it's gotten away from tradition, or that this was something where this is how they kick off their Saturday evening, or whatever the case may be. Where are you on sort of the pro-con of the idea of having this iconic program shifted to a permanent, well, permanent as far as the series, Sunday slot?
I think it's great. I think Sunday night is a great idea. I think Saturday it's a tough night for television. It's a tough night for television. And you know what? Like, it doesn't really... Does it really matter anymore? I mean, you know, like...
Not in Haley's house.
Yeah, you know, there's so many people who watch TV on demand nowadays. Like, I don't think it really matters. So the thing that I was going to say is, you know, Saturday tea time television is a lot different in 2018 than it is in 1965 or even 1975 or even 1985. And Doctor Who, you know, to me, it's family viewing. It's a show for everybody. And the show works best when it realizes that, not when it clings to tradition or to continuity. It works best when it goes, hey, this is a show for everyone. And so I think Sunday nights is a great place to put it, because casual viewers will watch it. They'll be home. Kids will watch it. They'll be home getting ready for school. I think it works. It works really, really well. So I'm excited about it. I think it's a great move.
Okay. Another aspect of what's going to be, well, what has been stated from Chibnall and Company going forward is that we are going to have little to no recurrence of past well-known monsters, villains, and baddies. You know, a whole new set of things to terrify us and creep us out, as I believe he was phrased. So what do you feel about the idea of not having any of our tried and true monsters and creepy crawlies to take series 11 forward?
I think it's great. You know, one of the things that I always say is one of the most perfect seasons is season 7 with John Pertwee, and I don't think there's a returning monster in it. I think it's great. I think that you can't take it in a vacuum. I think that if Chris Chibnall said my entire run of Doctor Who will be free of Daleks and Cybermen, he'd be fooling himself. But I think saying my first year is going to be about formulating something new and moving forward, I think that's great. And it's good to give these things a rest. They always come back stronger. They always make us miss them. You know, and when you feel like I've got to have the Daleks in every year, then you get stuff that you kind of go, whoa, wow, that's terrible. You know, and you get, you know, it's, you get some ideas that would have been really nice if they'd been rested for a couple of years, you know, I mean, so I always think it's a great idea. I to me, it's like the Doctor, the only thing that needs to be in it, it's, I can't remember what somebody said one time. I think it may have been Stan Lee or it may have been Joe Quesada, but they said, you know, Spider-Man stories only need a couple of things. They need Peter Parker, they need Spider-Man, and they need like J. Jonah Jameson. That's the only elements you need to keep. Everything else can change. And I feel that way about Doctor Who. You need the Doctor and you need the TARDIS and you need some friends that he hangs out with. And everything else, it's changeable. And that's what keeps it alive.
Hmm. One thing I don't think I've come across yet in any of the conversations was whether or not we're going to be spending any more time interacting with the Time Lords directly. They, you know, wasn't included with the roster of adversaries, even though the Time Lords tend to be more adversarial than not. but that aspect of it has not yet, or at least that card has not been shown. So I'd be curious to see if that's going to play in at all in light of the fact that, well, I'll get to the last thing we were going to chime in with you on. There's a conversation going around right now that is based on a statement Chibnall made to the press, saying that there was going to be very little time spent, very little mention or emphasis paid to the change of gender. That it was just, you know, there would be a couple of points where it just has to be a quick correction of you mean she? Oh, she. Okay, right. And they go on from there. So they are not going to be, as some people were anticipating, that this was going to be some sort of, you know, SJW beating me over the head with this time and time again. Like, this is just going to become their shtick. And he walked back and said, no, this is absolutely not going to be the case. Some folks have actually said, well, maybe we want you to make a little bit of a case of it, just a little bit of a case. You know, how are you walking that line? Where do you feel that line may be or could comfortably be so that it's not doing any disservice, but it's not pulling from quality of story in any way?
Yeah. I mean, I would not want to be in their shoes. That's so hard. You know, like, there's just no way you're going to be able to make everyone happy. And I think you need to be secure enough and go, okay. Personally, me, like, I feel like a little part of me feels that you just need to have Jodie be the best doctor she can be. And you need to serve her. It's one of the most kind of, like, actor-driven television series that exists in the world, you know, because it is based so much on the personality of the person playing the doctor. So... Mm-hmm. You know, if she says to you, like, I don't want to talk about it. I just want to be the doctor. Like, to me, that's what's going to shut people up who have a problem with it quicker than anything else. I always think about, like, their decision to make Patrick Troughton face the Daleks in the first adventure he had. And because that's how they knew that they were going to shut everybody up, right? Like, the Daleks see him, the Daleks focus in on him, and there's that great moment in the end of that episode where he's scared of them and they're scared of him. And after that, what more do you need, right? So part of me feels like you could do lots of stuff where it's like, oh, you know, I'm wearing a dress or whatever you want to say that would be silly and ridiculous. Or you could just let Jodie Whittaker get on with being a great actor and play the Doctor. And I think that's going to convince people more than anything else. It's like, yeah, she just defeated an alien menace with a teacup and a, you know, line of string and whatever other things that she did. And that's very Doctor-ish. And I don't know. What do you guys think? I mean, do you guys think that it should be an issue that they bring up? What do you think?
I think she is the Doctor. She is a woman. Yeah. You don't really have to talk about it after that. Like, the way she interacts with the world will be different than if she were a male doctor, but you don't have to make a point of being like, and she's a woman.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't think it would have to be any different than any other instance where you have a returning character, whether it be Kate Stewart or anybody else who has to say, oh, Doctor's changed again. Okay, got it. And it just doesn't, gender irrelevant. It's a new face, new persona. I have to go through this learning curve once again because this mad, brilliant alien is going to be off the eccentric charts once again, and I have to compensate.
I would rather them do things that they're not talking about gender, but she says something like, "Oh, none of my boots fit anymore," or something like that.
Right. I mean, I remember someone saying, it might have been on Verity, but I remember someone saying, like, you know, wouldn't it be great if she realized their coat, you know, didn't have pockets and she was annoyed by it, you know, because so many women's clothes don't have pockets, you know, or it'd be better if she did have pockets in it and all that sort of stuff. I mean, like, I think there's clever little ways that they can point it out. But at the end of the day, I mean, she's got to just save the Earth. That's what she has to do.
And, not necessarily Earth, any planet.
Well, any planet, yeah. Sorry. Earth-centered. She's just got to save the universe. And, you know, I think as long as she does that, then I'll be happy. It's a tough... I don't know how they're going to do it. It's a tough needle to thread, so...
Absolutely. Jay, any take on that?
Yeah, I think that not addressing it is probably the safer option because you don't want to make such a big deal about it because some of the irate fans are already going to be doing that for you. So if you do address it, just, yeah, have it be, a slight bent on feminism where somebody assumes that she doesn't know how to do something because she's a woman and then have her just, you know, read them the Riot Act and, like, start listing credentials or something like that. Be like, don't ever assume that I don't know what I'm talking about or something along those lines where that's really the only thing that you need to do to address it if you do anything at all.
Well, all it is just another variation on what one of the doctor's go-to mottos is, which is you walk into the room as if you own the place, and that's and wait for anybody to call you out on it. The person that calls you out on it is probably going to be your adversary for the remainder of the story.
Yeah.
So, I think it's a matter of you do whatever is necessary to or make mention of it in whatever instances have to work within the explanation of the story itself, but never draw from the story. You don't curb the story around that. You find ways that that works within the tale to tell the best story possible.
Yeah.
All right. Jay, is it that time?
It is that time. It's news time.
As we mentioned, we do have the official announcement over this past week from the BBC confirming all the things that we thought were going to be happening, but they did throw us a bit of a curveball. Maybe their hand was forced? I don't really know as far as the exact date. So, Jay, what do we now know?
We now know that Series 11 is officially starting on October 7th.
Okay. Correct me if I'm wrong. That's a Sunday.
It is a Sunday.
Okay. Do we have a time?
We don't have a time yet.
No, nobody has a time.
Just the date, which, that's a heck of a lot more than we had before, but...
They just want you to sit down all day watching BBC America, and then eventually it will be on.
Well, BBC did announce that they were doing the marathon, so you'll be able to see everything from Rose to Twice Upon a Time. They're going to do the full run. I don't know if they're going to be including all the Christmas specials. I would believe that they will be. I think they are. I have to go back and check the roster, but I think they're actually just doing full sets there, so you'll get the chance to just slam through it all. Some folks are starting early because they don't feel they're going to be able to be ready in time, because October 7th will, thankfully, come around a lot faster than you expect. But since we don't have times yet, that's still going to leave a lot of things up in the air. And granted, that was like my second question, or my second sentence. First sentence was cripes, we finally got a date, and the second question is, all right, when? Because I want to know how that's going to affect everything on this side of the pond. We don't know anything from what BBCA is going to be doing. We don't know anything up in Canada about what Space is going to be doing as far as their dates. In fact, I don't even know. I'll have to check with the RFS guys whether or not the Space has even confirmed that they're going to be airing it on the same day. I'll have to check on that one. But we're still holding out that they're going to consider doing the repeat broadcasts in North America and do one simulcast with the UK, same time frame or same time slot with the offset, and then do it again prime time just to cut down on piracy and to just quell everybody's concerns about being spoiled and on and on and on and on and on. I don't know. I've seen some really, really great arguments for not doing that. They haven't swayed me, but because a lot of them have to do with, you know, looking at the network as saying, well, they're already going up against Walking Dead on Sunday nights. But to me, that's a moot point because, correct me if I'm wrong, we're going into the final season for that show, I believe.
I don't know. I quit watching like a year or two ago.
Yeah, me too.
I think most of us did. Well, a lot of people did, which is why I think they're finally going to be calling it quits and saying it's time to nail that one shut. But so that's a moot point after a little while, but it's also just a matter of, they say, well, if you're going to air it during the day, you're going to be going up against football. I don't know that that's going to be a genuine concern. I don't think BBCA has much to worry about the NFL.
Not a big crossover audience? Is that what you're thinking?
Well, I don't know if it's a matter of crossover audience or so much of it is just as Haley was saying, as you were saying as well, that there's live viewing versus, you know, is it really going to be hurting anything to have it air twice in that day? If a lot of people are DVRing it, they may set their DVRs for it while they're finishing whatever game is airing on whatever local network.
Right.
As soon as that game ends, the next game that's starting up is not one they want to watch. But, hop, hey, I've got my Who broadcast that just finished, so I'm going to flip over and watch that now.
Well, right. I've been saying since we've been talking about it, like, what else were they going to air in the middle of the day anyways? Just another rerun of Doctor Who. So why not show the new episode and then show it again in primetime?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think there are benefits to that, but again, it's all in my head. What do I know? Very little. and then the little bit is going along with this. They gave us this great little sort of teaser trailer, just funsy little thing that was rather cheeky, which seems to be the term that everybody likes to use on this, where we do this this 360 revolve around Jody, who's looking very CGI'd. She's very kind of soft around the edges on this clip, and you'll have to watch it closely and see, I don't know, how much After Effect work was done here. But she is literally standing in under a collapsing glass ceiling.
Yeah.
I mean, just...
I don't understand the metaphor. What's the name?
I don't know either. But she says whoops. So, she's good for one-liners. Whoops.
Yeah. Yeah.
What more do you need from a doctor?
I don't know. But I think there was actually an extra little aspect of that which sort of goes back to the people that were saying, maybe she's not going to be as whimsical and kooky and unpredictable as other doctors. Maybe we're getting away from it. Well, no. If she's doing damage to what looks, a multi-million dollar chandelier and ceiling, all this stained glass work over her head, and all she has to say about it is just this kind of half smirk, whoops. Yeah. I don't think I'm terribly concerned about her playing this rather stodgy.
Yeah. So, you're right.
The only thing that I thought was an interesting choice was the music. Granted, I don't think this has any bearing on anything that Seiko Nakanola is going to be doing for the scoring, but just for this in particular, as we're getting very close to series premiere, that there wasn't anything. Maybe they're trying to stay as far away from his compositions at this point, so that we don't get any indication of the tone and structure or anything that he's going to be putting into his scoring. So they said, all right, let's just grab this hip-hop track.
Right.
Did it seem a little unusual to anyone else that they went with this particular... I mean, I don't know who the artist was or whether this was anybody recognizable or if it was just studio musicians or what.
Yeah, I don't know.
It was a bit of a weird fit. I mean, I think it fit a little weird, and it but that's okay. I mean, I think that... I'm okay with not hearing that theme song or any of his music until I see the show. I think that's fine. But I did feel like watching it the first time, I was like, it's sort of never really been used in a way to advertise Doctor Who before, that kind of contemporary feeling of music. So
yeah.
It wasn't a bad thing. It just surprised me a little bit because I was like, oh, that's different, but I didn't think it was terrible.
Okay. Gotcha. All right. Well, when we convene next week, we got some surprises in store. We're not going to tip our hands on that. We're just going to let them sort of happen organically as they go. But we will be discussing actually something that we were just touching upon with Jeremy, and that has to do with the idea of new adversaries for Series 11. Now, specifically, we're not going to extend the discussion as to why we're not having Daleks and Cybermen and so forth, but this is really just a matter of what could be some of the interesting points of conflict or instances or baddies. If you could build a baddie, the build a baddie workshop that's taking over in the malls these days, which is not popular with the kids. What would we be doing, knowing the sort of the construct of the new TARDIS team that we've got? So we'll sort of take that one apart a little bit and have some sort of hypothetical fun with it, because we get to do those sort of things as we get into the month now before we finally have new content again. But Jeremy, thank you so much once again for joining us in the studio. This has been a blast.
Thanks for having me, you guys. I'm always glad to be here, and I love listening, so thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Anytime.
All right. Well, this has been episode 301 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, Kondo just really could add so much to this. I mean, 4 or 5 words total to this conversation. It'd be great.
And this is Kirsay. You still practice teleportation? How quaint. Now, if you got yourself a decent forklift truck.
And this is Haley saying, all that stands between us and immortality is a chimney sweep.
We'll see you guys next week.
And we'll see.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio or on Facebook @facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.